Global Competency in Education. So Nanette Tracks is not only the sister of Kimberly Burzak, but she earned her BA in English Literature from the University of Michigan, then taught English in Korea for 2 years. She studied elementary education with a focus on cross-cultural and language development from National University in La Jolla, California. She also has a master's degree in reading, instruction, and remediation from Lindenwood University. She's in her 26th year of teaching. She has taught students in grades 1 through 7 and is currently teaching reading at Fort Zumwalt North Middle School and serves as the district's reading curriculum coordinator for secondary schools. She was named Teacher of the Year in 2017 and was the 2018 recipient of the NEA Foundation Global Learning Fellowship for Missouri. Please welcome Nanette Tracks.
Thank you for having me here today. I know that it says South African Adventures, but I want to, while that is a really important part of what I want to talk about, that's right, and that sounds more exciting than developing global competency. I would give you that. So first, what I want to do is just talk about what is global competency and why it should matter. So it goes very handedly with the quote you just listened to, and that was planned, but if it was, it was perfect. So global competency really means that we need to develop in our students an understanding in all of our young people. So I think this goes to exactly what Luke was talking about. I don't believe that the general tenet in education right now is memorization. I think that there's a lot of work going into developing thinkers and problem solvers, and that's part of what the mission of developing global competency and global citizens is working toward. Because we need our students to understand that there are no issues that don't affect all of us. What's happening in some corner of the world does have implications to all of us everywhere. And when you're living in your own little world, you really don't have a sense. So that's what we need to be able to bring to our students, which is part of the mission of this idea in education. So what hardships people are suffering does drag all of us down. It affects all of us from really moving forward as a human species and really being able to take care of the world that we've created and the world that we've inherited. This isn't something that our students have a choice in understanding. We do live in a very global world, for better or for worse. There is a lot of interconnectedness through our economies, through our access to education, through the development of the kinds of ideas and situations we want to create for our students and the world that they inherit. So it's kind of a lot to think about, okay, well, I'm a first grade teacher, this kind of sounds like a big idea, or I'm a sixth grade teacher, this sounds like a big idea, but there are ways to make this accessible, and it's absolutely necessary that we make it accessible to our students. So one part of this mission is through the NEA Foundation, that's the National Education Association, they every year have a global learning fellowship. So they choose one teacher from every state, 50, and their mission is to help those teachers really develop an understanding for themselves, because you can't teach something that you don't understand. So developing an understanding of what does global competency mean? What does that really mean if you're gonna take this big idea and bring it into your own classroom? How do you make that something that teachers understand so that they can bring it to their students? How do teachers become advocates for global competency, not just within their classroom? So then how do we bring it out to other teachers and larger groups so that idea can spread? Because what ultimately we need is for our students to understand their role and their responsibility in a very interconnected world. So that's the reason I went to South Africa. It was not a vacation. I mean, it turned out to be that, but that's really the guiding principle behind it, is how do we bring this education to teachers so that they can bring it to their colleagues and their districts and then on to not just my own classroom students, but to entire populations of students. So again, that's the mission of the Global Learning Fellowship, is to train teachers so that we bring this kind of understanding to all of our students in K-12 education. So in order to be able to achieve this, there's just some pretty fundamental questions that we want to be able to ask ourselves as educators. And that was how this year of study began. So the Global Learning Fellowship is a professional development opportunity that they grant to teachers, but it's an entire year of study where we began with just kind of asking ourselves as a group of educators, what is it that we need globally competent students to be able to do and understand? So we started our year with a meeting of all 50 teachers in Washington, D.C., and really answering for ourselves these kinds of questions. And we could not obviously answer them in a weekend because these are pretty big questions. So what is it that we want our students to be able to do if we're going to call them globally competent? What do they need to understand? How do we get them there? And then what kinds of opportunities do we need to set up for our students in order for them to be considered globally competent? So to even have that language and be able to articulate it for ourselves. So it was really a year of study and answering for the group of teachers, because this is not something that was part of a teacher training program. This isn't something that teachers were taught in their initial training, but it's something essential that they be able to bring into their classrooms every day. So the guiding principle behind us answering that question was to look at the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And these are, basically commitments, 17 commitments that Cooperative of Nations have set forth and achieved with varying success. So the goals are very noble, but they're big. And to say that we've achieved even any of these in the United States, I don't think we could say with real confidence. I think we've made more progress on them than some other places in the world, but we're not there. And then if we cannot achieve them, do we really understand them? And then how do we bring that understanding back to our students? Because how do you take some of these bigger ideas and make those accessible to a first grader or a second grader or a sixth grader or a 12th grader? Not just that they understand that, but that they can come up with a perspective and some kind of action plan to their own responsibility on helping achieve these. Because people anywhere who don't have access to clean water affects all of us. People anywhere who don't have access to quality education affects all of us around the world, because we're stuck. We know we can read the newspaper. We're stuck in this loop of, well, we can't stop giving aid to refugees in, fill in the blank, because then what happens to those people? But we really aren't moving forward on these goals when we shortchange people's understanding of how to get there, or what they mean, or what are the real implications to all of us. So so part of our mission in this year was to really explore each of these in depth, and then create lessons for kindergartners through 12th grade that would address students in understanding what the issues are related to each of these sustainable goals, but then coming up with some kind of action plan that they themselves, in their own life, so some of it's just becoming a leader in your own life to make sure you are not falling victim to one of these things. So, for example, if our second graders are exploring what are the implications of not having access to clean water. So kind of exploring that, you know, what happens when people, you know, and you can do it with lessons right here in the United States, talk about Flint, or you can talk about people in sub-Saharan Africa who don't have access to clean water, who are then in need of people there to dig wells. So first understanding, what does that mean to have clean water? And then talking about action items that those students can implement. So could you fundraise to build a well? Could you make sure that your own local drinking water is clean and go to your city council? That's pretty powerful and accessible to younger students. So the takeaway from all of that is to really consider, now what? So now what do I do in my classroom? And how do I explain this to my students? So part of that idea is pretty simple, that rising tide lifts all boats. Like that when we improve the situation of people anywhere, we improve the situation of people everywhere. And really helping students to understand that there is no us and them. There is no othering that advances anybody's cause. If you can develop empathy and understand the stories of other people, that makes our growing population, our maturing population, much more likely to be understanding of people who are still without access to education, without access to food security, without access to infrastructures that help communities develop. So the end game of all of this, so after this year of study, which was pretty intense because there's a lot of really heavy issues that we need to learn to understand and understand at a level where we can break them down and bring them to our students. So when the year of study was finished, we all, 50 of us, engaged in a field study to South Africa to kind of really look at what is life like in another culture? Because really, if you can understand people's stories and develop empathy, you can't dismiss their needs, and their needs are real. So we did all of this study with a focus on South Africa. Just, you could have picked anywhere in the world. Different cohorts of fellows have gone to China, they've gone to Brazil, they've gone to Peru, and it just happened that this year they went to South Africa. So as they're exploring these bigger issues with a micro-focus on any one part of the world, you can transfer that same understanding to any part of the world to understand their situations. So when I did get to South Africa, we had done a lot of reading to understand the history of South Africa before we went. And as a reading teacher, I would like to say that's a really good substitute for actually experiencing things, but it's very secondary. So going and doing is really, there's no substitute for that. So one thing that was a focus of our particular trip was looking at schools, visiting schools, different kinds of schools, understanding the educational system there, because it's different everywhere. In terms of Africa, South Africa has a very high literacy rate. In terms of more developed countries, it's pretty abysmal. They are at a sixth grade at a 41% literacy rate, and we want to really criticize schools in the United States. We're up over 90% at sixth grade. So the literacy rate there is really not enough to propel growth in that country. So when you're looking at a 41% literacy rate, you're looking at nearly 60% of your population that does not have, by sixth grade, the basic reading skills that they need in order to function in the world. So really exploring, well, why is that? so a huge part of that is the legacy of apartheid in that country. Their public schools right now are funded at a pretty substandard level. So it took me a while to really understand that public-private split there. Here, when we consider a public school, it is free. You go, you get the things that you need, and if students can't pay one other penny, they still have access in every place throughout our country to a basic skills education. And we can argue that in some places, and it is true, that really isn't equitable, and it is not equitable. There is access to a basic skills education for every student in this country. In South Africa, what they consider a public school, students almost always have to pay an additional school fee because the basic funding for public schools really does not allow for a school to even have barely a building. So a teacher is not accessible in the level of that a government is funding the schools. So often, we only visited one school that was completely what we would consider public. The teacher, there was one teacher, there were over 60 students of all grades, up to probably sixth or seventh grade age. After that, there just were no older students. They had all left school. There were no desks. So students were sitting on the floor. They had some, almost like what we consider like a composition notebook, and it was for every subject. There were no books it was a one-room school. There were no books. The teacher didn't have a proper blackboard. She had a cardboard that had been rubbed over with shoe polish, and she was writing on that and erasing it. But the bigger factor there is she herself, while a lovely person and doing the best job she knew how to do, was not really educated. She really had basic literacy skills herself, which is part of that legacy of apartheid. Because during apartheid, they had what's called Bantu education, which was for the black and colored people, and they make a distinction there, and they still use those terms, which was a little uncomfortable for us as Americans. They use those terms very freely still. They don't even necessarily consider them pejoratives the way that they use them, but they make a distinction of black people are just people who have darker skin, most likely with their full-blooded native African people, and that they have colored people, which are Indians who were imported as slaves for many, many years, and they're mixed race. So they're basically, they're looking at, you know, you're colored, you're black, you're white, and they're making kind of arbitrary distinctions. And that was implemented systematically during apartheid, and they had, you know, different ways that they identified people. You know, if they stuck a pencil in your hair and it did not fall out, then you were considered either colored or black, and then that limited what kind of education you would get. So they had just, and much more, some kind of tests where they would, it's kind of gross, but they would do like anal probes, like with a pin, and because they said, well, whatever language you scream out in pain in determines your race. So if you screamed out in pain at that in English or Afrikaans, then you were considered white, and you know, depending on what other language, so Indian, then you were colored, and if it was in a tribal language, it was black. So they and they carried cards that had their identification of their race, and they had to have it at all times. They were limited to living in certain sections of the city. So a lot of times during apartheid, they would come in overnight and round up everyone who was living in a particular part of the city. If they wanted to redesignate that a white area, they would round them all up. You now live over here. They would level the houses and reconstruct a neighborhood that was then exclusively for white people. So this is not ancient history, which is another thing that's a little powerful to understand. This didn't end in 1994. before. I was done with college and teaching at that point. So this is not ancient history. These are people my age who grew up in that system. So part of the educational legacy of that is that students who were designated anytime between 1948 and 1994 as colored or black were to receive a Bantu education, which limited the instruction to basic literacy and job skills. They were not, by policy, they were not taught math, and they were not taught science, and they were not taught any kind of more complex literacy skills. So what does that mean? That means you have an entire population of adults who grew up in that system. Who's going to be teaching? You have over 80% of your population grew up in that education system. And when apartheid ended in 1994, a lot of white people took their money and they left because they realized, oh, well, this gravy train is over. I'm hightailing out of here. And so then you had an even bigger part of your population who grew up without a real education. So there has been some efforts at rehabilitation and providing those adults education, but it's so limited that it really can't affect change. So one interesting conversation I had while we were there, because we did some in-country travel, I was on an airplane and I sat next to a man who was a South African businessman. He was probably very similar to my age. We were talking about our kids, which are very similar in age. And he has a house in Stellenbosch, which is the South African equivalent of like Napa Valley. So it's a very beautiful area, wine country, right on the coast, very wealthy, almost exclusively even now white area. And he flies up to Johannesburg every week in order to run his business. He's an engineer at a platinum mine. So as we're talking, and it seems like there's a lot of Americans on this flight. This isn't typical for Monday morning. And, you know, he's kind of asking me what we were doing there. And he, when discovering that I was a teacher, he goes, well, maybe you can teach them something here because we need to just get past this. Because we've been giving people handouts now for 25 years. We need to be caught up. They need to be just, you know, people just need to be making their way on their own merit now. And I said, well, we're 150 years out of something very similar, and we're not there yet. So so I would say at 25 years, they've made a lot more progress than we had made after the end of slavery in 25 years. There's a lot more open conversation about the past. But logistically, there's no way in 25 years. You have your first group of children who were born now just reaching adulthood, you know, what they call the born frees, they're just reaching adulthood. And they, unless their parents were able to pay additional monies for school fees, which is very difficult to do, they were in a classroom. If they were in a classroom, because education is not compulsory, they were in a classroom with a teacher who herself most likely could not read past a second or third grade level. So you can't teach something, again, you can't teach something that you don't know. So when I tried to explain that, the logistical, like you're not going to be there for a very long time. And his response, he goes, well, then maybe I should just leave for Europe too, is what he said. So really no ownership of the situation that his own country is in. And no real understanding of why they're still there. Like, really, the investment that needs to be happening because that is lost on him. And that his ship cannot rise without rising everyone's. So that was a 45-minute flight, but really one of the most enlightening parts of my whole trip, because it made me understand how even in this very small area, they really don't have a grip, or many people don't have a grip on how long that legacy will haunt them. because they've got miles to go before they even have people, enough people who can teach the students who are rising. So when we, you know, get all grief-stricken about the state of education in the United States, we need to remember that. We do have many, many talented, gifted teachers. We are at least funding our schools at a minimum. You could argue that we have a system of school fees similar to theirs, in that what makes our public schools inequitable is our property tax system. Mm-hmm. So why is it that schools in St. Louis City have very different educational situation than 3 miles away in Ladue? It's not because they have better students, it's because they're funding their schools differently. So instead of having parents individually pay those school fees to access what we would consider a better education, higher quality education, they're paying it individually. So if you can afford to live in a better area, then you do. And if you can't, then you are stuck with often a very substandard educational setting. However, we also have that same attitude, you know, well, you shouldn't really live there. Why don't you get yourself together and move to a better neighborhood? So we suffer that same really myopic view on improving access. How do we, if we're going to be honest, how do we really improve access to education for every student in this country? It's much the same work that they have to do in South Africa. So that's the kind of reflection that it's a little tough to take. You know, it's not us and them, and it's not them who's really, you know, they need to get it together. They need to pull themselves out of this legacy of apartheid. They need to be funding their schools properly. Well, so do we. We need to equalize that access. We need to say, well, what is our funding formula for education in Missouri? How is it that money from the federal government filters down to different states inequitably? What are we doing about that problem? And what are the implications to us if we don't fix it? So there was a lot of, we did do some fun stuff. It wasn't all doom and gloom and visiting schools like, what? How can we fix this? I did meet some really amazing educators. I met some very forward-thinking school administrators. There were a lot of schools that we visited that did have crisis counselors, because the other thing that South Africa has in common with us is they have a lot of immigrants. Until pretty recently, they had a very liberal immigration policy. So many people from other parts of Africa, which are struggling with very serious issues, have made their way to South Africa. So one particular school we visited was a school of almost entirely immigrants. And many of the students that we visited, it was a K-12 school, many of the students who were enrolled there were refugees from other countries. So we met students from the Congo, from Angola, and in that school, they set up kind of just an open forum where we could talk to the younger students, talk to the middle grade students, and then talk to the upper grade students. But they don't call them students, they call them learners, which I loved. I was like, I need to just like train myself. I love that, calling them learners rather than students. That was my opportunity to really talk to a lot of high school students. And two of the four girls that I talked to were there as refugees, one from the Congo, one from Angola, and they were there without their parents. One other student was from Ethiopia who was there with her family, but they had, their parents were not deceased, but their parents had basically smuggled them over the border, and that smuggled them out of the border. They were allowed to get into South Africa, but getting them out of their country was really the bigger part of the process. And their parents had paid someone to get them safely into South Africa, and they were living there on their own. It was not a boarding school. They had
I couldn't even exactly understand the situation. It was something like a boarding house. So it was many students living in like studio apartments, and then they had one meal a day that a house mother cooked. So one meal a day was all that were guaranteed. The schools almost never serve food. They don't have cafeterias and things like that like we do. So the two girls that I was speaking with were there not only on their own as 16 or 17 year olds, each of them had younger siblings who were also at the school who they were taking care of. So the level of hardship that those students were enduring, but they did it because they understood the value of education. So there is amongst the young people some awareness that this is the way out. This is the way we change the situation, and not just for ourselves, for all of the generations coming up behind us. They were mature beyond their years, but we also have that exact same situation of minors coming across into our borders. People don't do that because it's comfortable or they think they're going to have a good time. People do that because they're desperate. And it's, you know, same problem with a different face that we are struggling with here. Oh, I went too far. Hold on. Oh, there we go. So then with all of that, because there were some pretty heartbreaking things that I did experience and learn, how do I bring that back to a group of 12-year-olds in O'Fallon, Missouri? Because it needs to be kind of doled out in a way that engages them rather than pushes them away, because young children take these kind of things very personally, and they do feel an ownership, and part of it is they don't really understand how big the world is and how small the world is. That's kind of a funny way to say it, but they get very tortured by hearing about other people's hardships. So you need to be able to deliver it in a way that's palatable to them. So this is just a small little introduction. So this was just, obviously this doesn't go into in-depth, but just bringing up some of the things that we will continue to explore throughout the year was a good way to just get the students kind of curious, know that it wasn't just a vacation that I went on, that we really did explore some of the issues and the history and how they're dealing with difficult problems in their part of the world. And then from this, there's a springboard into really exploring other cultures, including African stories. Because I teach reading, I teach a nonfiction reading skills class. I teach a remedial version of that class and a gen ed version. But because it's nonfiction, and really my curriculum is to make sure students have access to the skills and strategies that they need to effectively read nonfiction, I'm pretty open as to the kinds of things that we read in order to develop those skills. So what I've created, even before I went on this, but into and expanding on what I had started before, really bringing to students' awareness what other people's experiences are throughout the world, and making that experience very human and accessible to them. So we read about some of the bigger names you might expect. We read an article about Malala Yousafzai and her struggle to help girls access education in her part of the world. We read about refugees who are escaping civil war in Sudan. So we read a memoir about them. We also look at stories of people who have come into the United States as refugees and other immigrant stories, just so that the students have some understanding that those are real people who have real stories just like them. And building that empathy and awareness is crucial. So what's next? This year I'm embarking on a collaborative effort with some of the other teachers from this group on teaching students
about the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, okay, the history on that, and then breaking down the 30 articles, and students, my students will do 15 of those articles kind of broken down and do a video summary and explanation of whether or not they think that these articles are being implemented effectively in their own lives and their own communities, and then the other teachers will do the other 15, create their students will create videos answering that same question on 15 other articles, and then we can do a video exchange and students can respond to all 30 of the articles. But if I were to hand that paper, okay, we're gonna read this, that would not be something that would excite my students. But breaking it down to the individual articles, explaining the history behind this document and what it was meant to achieve and how we're still struggling to achieve these in different parts of the world, makes it something that they can understand, because they are very able to understand this document when it's broken down and presented in a more middle school friendly way. But it's a very important document, something that they absolutely need to be aware of, and can develop their understanding and their own responsibility in implementing these and ensuring that they're implemented in other places throughout the world. The other part of this is the cohort has written a book of lessons for students in kindergarten through 12th grade that do each, throughout the lessons, if students really did every one of these lessons from kindergarten through 12th grade, they would have lessons that help them understand each of those 17 sustainable development goals at different in an age-appropriate way. So it starts in kindergarten and first grade with them just carrying buckets of water. How hard is it to carry a bucket of water across your playground? How hard is that to do that? How heavy is that? So what happens when somebody has to do that every day? And they don't have to just carry one bucket. They have to go down to the river, and they're not walking across their playground. They have to walk all the way to their house. So how far is that to your house? That's something a kindergartner absolutely can understand. So what happens to people? I know what that means. What happens to students who have to do that every day? How much time would that take? And then the real implications of someone who has to do that every day. How come they can't go to school? What happens if they can't go to school? So just developing that understanding and that empathy, you know, why don't they just turn on the faucet? That's what a first grader is going to think. Well, why don't they just turn on the faucet? So really explaining to them that not everybody has that, and then what does that really mean? So what does that mean then when we have a whole village of students who never get to go to school because all they're doing all day long is carrying water back to their home? So the 12th grade then gets into a capstone project where they have to actually create a 501c3, where they have to create a nonprofit that would help tackle one of these issues in one place. So it could be internationally or it could be domestically, but that's like the capstone project for the 12th grade version. And there are some schools that in their senior year do have a capstone project that is directly linked to these. There are not very many, but we can just hope that will expand as people and educators' understanding of what our young people need to have ownership of and that they can take action. So what I would like to do now is to go over one of these lessons. So that's what the lines on the floor are for. So I think, oh, well, please, that works too. So we are gonna have to kind of line up. So I need like 10 volunteers, and then we'll just group up from there. So we just need to kind of open this up. Maybe just pull this back here back. And if we just turn these ones around, then I need 10 a short biography of a student somewhere in the world. Well, maybe not a student. So if you want to just read that, and then just pick somebody around, whose partner, so somebody else can help you out with that, and read that with you, and you'll be the representative on the walk. So just find another partner who does not have a card, share that with them so that they can all see what one of the bios looks like.
Is that something that is possible?
Can this be
like one step thing?
If it's a substandard, so yes, we can use our judgment, absolutely.
One step.
So our next step, if the teacher in that school in your community is well trained, you get to take one more step. So just showing up, even if the teacher's not great, does have some value. If the school in your community has books and supplies, you get to take another step. So you can see already you've got discrepancies in the amount of progress people have access to. If your school has services to provide for education for someone with your disability, step forward one step. So if you are a disabled student, and your school has services to serve you, you may take one step forward. Because many, many places throughout the world, students who have disabilities just cannot go to school. Students in a wheelchair who have no way to get to a school, or their school has no ramp, cannot physically get to school. Students who are visually impaired, if there is no one who can teach them to read Braille, they have no school to attend. Students who have pervasive developmental delays can learn, but if there's no one available to teach them, often those students throughout the world just stay at home. They never get to attend school.
So if they don't have a disability, they still...
They didn't move out.
They don't know.
Okay. So if your community has clean water easily available, step forward one more. If your family does not need you to go to work to earn money to help sustain them, you get two steps on this one.
If it doesn't say anything about it?
So sometimes you might have to infer a little bit, but if it doesn't say anything, like if it's just explaining the situation of the student, I can answer my question. If your family and your community allows people of your gender to attend school, step forward two steps. This is another thing that our students really in this country have a hard time understanding, is that in other places around the world, that if a family has to choose to pay the school fees of one child, more often than not, they choose the oldest male child. And very often, that's all the resources the family has and any of the other children and families. If your community or country is not at war, step forward one step. So, so the purpose of this is to really demonstrate to students that it's not laziness, it's not lack of will that often prevents people from moving forward in their lives. I don't know how we're doing on time, but what I have my students do at this point is just talk about where they are. So I have them with their partner talk about where their position is and the kinds of things that have impacted their ability to get to the point where they can earn a living wage. The other thing I point out is that nobody made it here just on the circumstances of their birth. So all of my students, for the most part, have access to all of these. There's another huge several steps that need to happen, and that's individual accountability, so I do talk to my students about that. Just being given these things does not guarantee you anything. The other part of finishing your way here is yours. So individual accountability is some of it. It's certainly not all of it. So that's something that they need to separate, because very often I think very often people have that idea that, you know, well, they just need to get together. They just need to do it on their own, which is partly true. But it doesn't get you all the way there, no matter what. So
it would take a lot of tenacity for somebody still at the very back to ever make it up to this point. And most people are not in a position to be able to do that. So this is just a pretty demonstrative way for the students to see that and have an understanding. So thank you for